The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong from Washington, D.C., speaking to you from the convention of the World Future Society, the second annual meeting of a very large number of scientists from every specialized field imaginable gathered here in Washington, D.C. to exchange ideas, to give speeches, and to hear them. The main speaker of the luncheon tomorrow is to be Senator Edward Kennedy, a name that is very familiar to Americans and Canadians alike. Speeches already delivered have varied from the very wildly optimistic of Dr. Herman Kahn, the head of the Hudson think tank, who is also here, and a man that I have interviewed on the World Tomorrow program and television broadcast at least twice in the past. And what you hear and what you see here at this conference varies all the way from the very wildly optimistic, that is, that all the problems of humankind are virtually being solved right now, to the very, very gloomy. But the facts are that these scientists, at least generally, had to listen to the words of the opening remarks by the president of the organization, who very clearly stated that never in all of human history have so many people taken such a serious look at the future of mankind, and never has it been so necessary, because never has the human race faced such an overwhelming crisis and, he called it, a stupendous opportunity. He had to admit in opening remarks given before 2,000 people here in the large ballroom at the Hilton Hotel that the future is darkened by the possibility of thermonuclear war, environmental destruction, and the potential collapse of the economic and social systems that sustain our very lives. But he went on to say that the future is also brightened by the knowledge that we have within our power the ability to create a civilization incomparably superior to any yet known in all the annals of history. I will take exception to those remarks and also underscore a few of them. I believe, as you see these scientists gathered here to both listen and to talk about the future of the world, from everything from agriculture to genetics to trying to farm the seas or live in domed cities or control crime or to change the entire future and the fate of all of humankind. They talk about everything from literal utopia, one gentleman delivering a paper about a painless utopia, trying to do away with all of human pain, one man seriously stating that the very children being born today will live to be 200 years of age. I think that you have to view what is happening here in Washington, D.C. at this futurist conference in the backdrop of what's happening elsewhere in the world. And to me, the main speeches made in the opening day, and especially those statements by Edward S. Cornish, who is president of the World Future Society, would bear some very close scrutiny, because I think I find a fair amount of what appears to be contradictory information. For example, in the opening speech heard by about 2,000 people here, the gentleman had, of course, to admit the threat of disaster. But he said that this offered the opportunity to mobilize people to do what they need to do that they might find difficult and onerous. But the potential cataclysm we now confront gives us a great opportunity to create a united humanity. The Future Society is apparently hoping to start a kind of a network to play a key role in determining what sort of future the human race will have. Now, that's all very nebulous. It is not a governmental organization. As a matter of fact, anyone can join merely by sending about $12 to the address which they list, and you're automatically put on the subscription list of their publication that comes out merely by listing your own address and your name. The society has members in all 50 states and active chapters in cities such as New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., here, Phoenix, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Boston, and even over in London, England. And it has been a rapidly growing group of scientists, even of government officials and businessmen, perhaps, also of college students, practically anyone. There's a great deal of controversy here, as I said. Opinions vary about the future from the wildly optimistic to the very gloomy and the pessimistic. But some of the words that were given in this opening speech are very, very informative, and I think we need to look at what is the hope for the future. As you're probably reading in your newspapers, press releases from some of the speeches made here, very glowing reports about aging, about the science of medicine, the relief of all kinds of pain, about a virtual utopia, Herman Kahn's statement that we, through technology, could probably feed five times the present population of the world, or about 20 billion people. So it bears a little bit of scrutiny in the light of the harshness and the serious realities of today. They say the future of the world is the primary responsibility of a relatively small number of people. But they say those people are those who can understand the dimensions of the crisis the world is in and who can influence world policies in constructive directions. I'd like to know who in the world those people are, where they live, what their names are, and exactly what they do. I have just come from Brussels at the NATO summit conference, where I saw the heads of state vying and juggling back and forth, every one of them with their own national selfish interests to be concerned with, first of all, each one of them with elections facing him eventually, several of them having risen to positions of power over the bodies of their dead compatriots, the revolution in Portugal, noteworthy, and even a matter of great concern among some of the NATO countries, and that was the opportunity for the 13 prime ministers assembled there, as well as a top representative from the nation of France, at least the foreign minister who was there, even though the prime minister was not, to take a look at one another and to listen to President Gerald Ford once again assert that the United States is not losing leadership and that the United States will fulfill its commitments to its NATO allies. But judging from what I heard in Brussels and judging from the conditions of the world right now in Africa, where we have seen the enormous loss of life in the sub-Sahara, where we have seen the incredible agonies of one war after another in country after country, tearing those countries apart, where you see utter and total illiteracy, where you see drought and famine, where you see horrible depravity of every conceivable description, the massive and enormous problems of that very populated so-called dark continent. Then as you look at the Middle East and the seemingly insoluble problems between the Arabs and the Israelis, which could literally bring the world to the brink of nuclear war, when you look at the growing emergence of the communist Chinese with a nuclear arsenal that grows greater every single month, when you look at the great technology that is Japan, and the fact that many more nations such as Japan are going to enter into the atomic or the nuclear club by building their own nuclear weapons, they will simply have to because of the geopolitical balance of power that exists. When you look at the very, very fragile flow of energy resources and supplies from basically Arab Middle Eastern oil states, and the fact that all of the industry of Europe, of the industrial might of Japan, and even to a greater and an increasing degree, the technology of the United States has to depend upon the vital flow of oil from that part of the world. Then, when you look here in the United States with the enormous sociological problems, the problems of racism, the problems of extremism at all extremes, of even terrorist and paramilitary organizations, runaway, unbelievable crime, and certainly Washington, D.C. is a city that underscores as a microcosm of much of the rest of the world the problem of runaway crime. It is not safe not only to walk on the streets at night in the city of Washington, D.C., but it's very, very unsafe even to ride around in taxis or to drive in your automobile. And when you look at the statistics of crime in this city, you look at the population or the demographics of it, the disproportionate amount of crime rate of certain sociological groups. And by the way, in Washington, D.C., the white people are definitely in the minority. They're a minority group here. So I'm not speaking of minorities in that sense. But when you look even at the nation's capital, at the squalor and the slums which I have just seen, and I can go out and photograph them and show you some of the most incredible pictures of horrible old wretched-looking buildings of people living in dwellings that are not literally fit for pigs, and yet you can see right over the tops of their faces the despair that they view the world with, the unemployment, the horrible incidence of crime, of venereal disease that exists in that itinerant and that impoverished segment of Washington, D.C.'s population, and yet they virtually live in the shadow of the capital. Now, as you view the entirety of the world and the realities of the world, it seems to be just a little bit optimistic to be here, hearing all of these glowing speeches of how we're just about through all the problems now in a matter of just a very few years. As Herman Kahn said, we probably are going to come out of all of the problems of the world and head on into broad avenues of a wonderful, wonderful new world that they envision, where we will have solved most of all of the main problems. Really, when I hear speeches like that, I wonder what kind of an unreality some of these people are dwelling in. Herman Kahn said the next 10 years will mark one of the most important turning points in all world history, and with that, I can certainly agree. Dr. Kahn is the founding director of the Hudson Institute. It's a policy analysis center, or many people call it a think tank, in upstate New York. And he talks about the most incredible visionary dreams for the future you can imagine, such as the slowing down of present population growth rates. He talks about how we're going to avoid all of these horrible problems of food and population and so on. As a matter of fact, as I may have referred to earlier, he said it is technically feasible for the world to produce enough food to feed 20 billion people, about five times the current population. He also expressed confidence that the problem of energy sufficiency in the world is without doubt in process of solution. And he called, and this is a very interesting point, energy a transient socio-economic problem rather than one of technology or resources. Now, that, I think, bears a little bit of argument. In the first place, energy, as maybe you could go and look up in the dictionary, would be defined, is produced from resources. Fossil fuels, oil, coal, in other words, all the fossil fuels that exist as a natural resource here in the earth, it is produced by the flow of water through dams and through the hydroelectric process. We're now talking about atomic energy, solar energy, thermal energy, or geothermal energy, where there are alternative energy sources. But Dr. Kahn, instead of viewing the fact, there's a very frightening fact of the known reserves of the world, as far as oil is concerned, of the runaway incredible amount of the devouring of these natural resources of the earth through the intrusions of virtual runaway technology, yet says that changes in lifestyles that he calls relatively small would take us through this energy problem, such as better insulation, smaller vehicles, and mass transit. Now, that's a wonderful dream. Right here in Washington, D.C., as you go around through the streets now, it looks like they've torn the whole city apart, because practically wherever you look and at every intersection, there's a great deal of construction going on, the reason being that many cities, I shouldn't say many because I don't know that it's all that many, but at least Washington, D.C. and a few others, Oakland, California was one of recent note, have tried to do what should have been done many, many years ago, and what should never have been removed from those cities, which was taking away the streetcars and taking away other forms of rapid transit, and now are trying to put in subways or metros underneath the streets. Anyone who has had to deal with urban renewal, who has had to go through the agonies of various city planning commissions and of zoning variances and changes and the acquisition of property, known the squabbles between city and then county and then state and then federal agencies, known the difficulty in appropriating funds, and known just a little bit about what it's like to even try to put a highway through a portion of an old, tottering, decaying city, or try to settle on where to put an off-ramp for a freeway, is going to have a little time, a little difficulty sitting still and just hearing someone say, waving his hand in the air as if this is all going to be a marvelous thing that's going to happen in about 10 years, 10, 15 years or so. That's what they're talking about in the future, and calling it a relatively small change in lifestyle, which will be a result of higher energy costs. That simply means better insulation. Now, let's talk about better insulation and smaller automobiles. Sure, we could have produced smaller automobiles years ago. It's too bad we didn't. It's too bad we also didn't recognize the need for more than one person to drive in an automobile. But in our sociological patterns of the fear of one another, the rejection of one another, and the extension of one's own personality by driving a vehicle, which is in a sense an offensive weapon with which the person can both defend himself by locking the doors and assert himself by speeding and passing people, we have failed to see that all of these things should have at least had some sort of a beginning, that we should have seen a definite trend in that direction many, many years ago to ever expect that we're going to see all of these changes in lifestyles. The last time I looked, some of the sales of large automobiles were dramatically up in the United States, and it's unbelievable, with cars costing $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, and $12,000 and more, that nevertheless, even in the midst of our fantastic inflation, and in the midst of the energy crunch, and in the midst of soaring unemployment, people are buying those big, affluent, and luxury-style automobiles virtually as never before. Now, when Mr. Kahn talks about a solution which would combine the technique such as better insulation and smaller vehicles and mass transit, we're discussing a subject that is absolutely enormous. Many, many times I've commented that instead of building our homes the way they used to many years ago, out of stone, concrete block, or out of brick, so that they would be insulated in the case of hot summers and that they would keep the heat in the case of cold winters, that what we have done is to go to cheap tract housing, where we're having to burn enormous amounts of energy in the form of natural gas, in the form of coal or oil, or electricity, usually, with electrically heated homes. Yet this is what we have done in the United States by the literal tens of millions of people. And flimsy, thin, wooden, and other synthetic material walls on tract housing simply is not a practical thing. Yet it's the only thing most people can seem to afford. It is a very fine kind of housing for a very large segment of the middle class, working United States of America. What about all of those millions who live in trailer homes that are very thin-walled and notoriously difficult to heat, and that are not all that well insulated unless they've been winterized or built for a high area, and even then you have quite a number of problems with trying to keep warm in the things. And so when someone says better insulation, he's talking about a vast industry. He's talking about the entirety of the housing industry. He's talking about the location of perhaps, I don't know whether it's 50% or 70% of the entire workforce. And he's talking about dozens of companies that make every type of insulation material. And it just seems to me, trying to look at it from a completely practical point of view, that you're not going to bring about those changes just because you're a futurist and you make a speech before a few thousand people who are willing to listen. And he goes on to say that the vigorous development of new sources of energy, both through exploratory mining for conventional fuels and through applied technology for improving efficiency and harnessing new energy sources, is the third choice, and then says that we're virtually over the hill on the problem of the energy crisis. I simply have to take exception and say I most sincerely disagree. Continuing that optimistic forecast, though, Dr. Kahn generally discounted the idea about non-renewable resources of metal. He insists that many of them are abundant and that are virtually inexhaustible. And he mentioned iron and aluminum in that regard. He went on to say there were adequate supplies of other main industrial metals, thus putting him solidly at variance with many people in the industry itself, who are talking about ever-dwindling resources. And to underline their remarks, point to the fact of many an industrial nation, with the Japanese right out in the front scrambling all over the world, as it were, to try to get long-term leases on energy sources and on vital material sources, even in faraway Chile and Africa and many places of the world. Dr. Kahn was equally optimistic about the environment, and he said the ecology movement of the past decade is producing very meaningful results, especially in North America, Northwest Europe, and Japan, which should culminate in a basic victory for an essentially clean environment within 10 years. I'm going to make the prediction right now that that is absolutely a grossly optimistic statement that will not even begin to come remotely close to the truth. 10 years goes by in an almost unbelievable period of time. 10 years have gone whizzing by since I have been attending some of the American Association for the Advancement of Science meetings, where I have heard Dr. Kahn talk about the ideal city of the future, including his statement years ago made, I believe, right in the city of New York in a hotel there where I was at a press conference about the ideal city of the future, when he talked about the megalopolises. You may remember hearing me talk about those on a broadcast. And then he said each ideal city would have its certain quota of criminals and this and that. And we asked at that time whether he was going to open the jails to get these criminals to make sure that each city would have a balanced criminal population. He's very eloquent. He comes across very powerfully. He's a very, very large man and is quite engaging in his personality and therefore a lot of fun to listen to. But some of the things that are being proposed or some of the prognostications that are being made here remind me a little bit of some of the chapters out of the Old Testament of the Bible where kings of Israel would like to hear nothing but good news for the future. And when the prophet of the eternal would come along, he would be accused of telling them nothing but bad news. He would tell them that if they continued to break the natural living laws and the laws of God, that there were going to be terrible consequences, that perhaps it would even eventually cost him his life, that it would affect his family, it would affect his government, it would affect the military picture and the agricultural picture, that there would be drought, there would be crop loss, there would be insect infestation, there would be growing disease. There would be wars, and there would be losses in war. Well, sometimes the king got tired of hearing that, so he would call for a prophet of Baal. And the prophet of Baal, or the astrologer, or the Babylonian, or the stargazer, would give him exactly what he wanted to hear. The Bible condemns that many, many times, talking about those who say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Or those who would build a wall, daub it with mortar, and whitewash it. In other words, those who would tend to gloss over the really serious problems of the present and talk about hopeful trends in the future. Prognostication of the future is a very, very difficult and sometimes dangerous activity today, however, because the future can be suddenly shocking. It can just scare the daylights out of you almost on a daily basis. You're living in a time when literally nuclear war by accident is possible. You live in a time of the proliferation of nuclear weapons, as I have said recently on broadcast, to the tune of many, many times overkill. And I took quite a while on one program with the argument some people advance about whether it's 50 times, 20 times, or 30 times, and I've said so many times that once would be quite enough. And yet more and more nations are joining the nuclear club. The Middle East is absolutely pivotal, according to biblical prophecy, about what's going to happen in the near future. And it is not good news, because there is going to come some kind of a dramatic change of events in the Middle East, which is going to bring about a military response from Europe that is literally going to see pretty much conventional forces, and possibly even with tactical, that is to say limited, nuclear weapons being used in the occupation of many countries in the Middle East, including the nation of Israel at some time in the future. I've gone over those prophecies of Daniel 11 many, many times and said precisely that. It is going to happen. I've also talked about not only the proliferation of nuclear weapons from the terms of more nations joining the atomic club, but about the fact of the deployment of United States nuclear arsenals all over Europe and primarily inside Western Germany, and what that may mean for the future. So going back to the speech that was given at the very opening of this World Future Society Convention here in Washington, D.C., it was said by the president of the society, whose name is Edward S. Cornish, that the future of the world is the primary responsibility of a relatively small number of people, talking about those in a society and those of like mind, whom he calls concerned people, aware people, people who can understand the dimensions of the crisis we face and who can influence world policies. Well, he went on to say that the consensus on what the most urgent problems are must be achieved, and that then people must react to what those problems are, and that this consensus can be communicated to the general public and to political leaders who have the power to take appropriate action. I don't know, but somehow I am just left with a feeling of tremendous pessimism about any such words, which are rendered almost meaningless simply by the way things actually are. You have to understand that this world is facing a series of dramatic cataclysms such as we have never before witnessed in all of our imagination. we do literally face a time when the word Armageddon is going to be very inadequate to describe what will occur in this world. And any exercise in a lot of words that are very broad, very glowing about the future of the world is an exercise in not just the future, but perhaps in futility. You need to find out what Bible prophecy says is going to happen in the future, and to understand that in one way at least, these scientists' forecasts are correct. That is, the world is not going to be destroyed, and humankind is going to survive. In other ways, they are not correct, and that is that political leaders do have the power to take appropriate action, which they do not. That is that the energy crisis is just about over, which it is not. That is that the environmental crisis will be solved within 10 years, which they will not. That is that nuclear war must be or will be averted, which it will not. That is that the first step toward moving forward in a creation of a very harmonious and utopian kind of world is to get a lot of scientists and others together, which will do absolutely nothing to accomplish it, and you can mark my words. So you'll listen to a lot of scientific forecasts. You will hear a lot of wonderful statements. You will hear projections forward. But you know, we heard those back in the 50s when science and industry talked about what kind of a glittering world they would produce by 1975. Now, that world was not produced by 1975. Rather, entering into 1975, we saw the problems of the world looming larger, more seemingly defiant of solution, more literally insoluble than ever before. We live in a time now where the keynote, where the main word for all of us to consider is survival. And the questions ought to be faced plainly. It would seem to me that the future society could do a great deal more good if it would address itself to the problems of the present rather than dreaming about the possibilities of the future. Because unless we solve the problems of today, there just may not even be a world tomorrow. I can tell you, you can thank God that the Bible reveals, even though man does not have the ability, does not have the experience, does not have the wisdom, does not have the technology, and does not have the expertise to bring about a wonderful new global society, yet it's going to happen anyway, because Almighty God says He is going to have to step in and intervene and do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. You need to get your name on the mailing list of the current number of The Plain Truth, by the way, because some of our top editorial staff are here attending many of these lectures. There are several of them going on around me right now. As a matter of fact, I'm going to pick up this tape recorder and go visit a few of them. And we have many of our staff members, as I said, here, along with our Plain Truth photographers. And if you will write for the current number of The Plain Truth, you will get The Plain Truth reaction to more specifics of this World Future Society Second General Assembly here in Washington, D.C. As you know, it's tabloid now, coming out twice as often and jam-packed with interesting articles of really important events around the world as they do reflect upon the future. And it shows you exactly what the true overview is, but it does it in the light of Bible prophecy. Until next time, from Washington, D.C., this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.